everybody. My name is Nancy Morris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And I'd like to thank Clancy for inviting me to come here and share with you. I got sober pretty much in this group in 1971, and I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota now. There is one good thing about living in Minnesota, and that is that my nipples are erect almost all the time. Coming. Back. Well, I've been taught to look for the positive in things, you see, so that is a good thing about living there. I don't quite fit into the AA there, though, because I didn't get sober in a treatment center, and it's like the land of 10,000 treatment centers, and I don't really get it, but it's okay, I guess. I would also like to welcome the newcomers that are here tonight. I saw some people raise their hands, and I would really like to welcome you to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was new, I didn't have to raise my hand because I threw up on the floor, and it didn't take them long to figure out that I was a newcomer. And this was out in Thousand Oaks where I got sober, and that was my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know I was going to come to AA that night. I had been drinking as usual, and something happened that night and caused a problem at home, and I ended up, what I did was we had people watching the Super Bowl at our house all day. And I drank, I made Bloody Marys, and I never left the punch bowl. And when the last man left our house, I got in his car and left with him. And my three kids were in the house sleeping, and my husband was there, and he didn't know I left, and he didn't know where I went. And I called him a couple hours later to come get me, and he was kind of mad. And he came and he got me, and I was drunk, and he started yelling at me about my drinking, and that was the first time that he had ever confronted me about it. And I knew long time before that I had a drinking problem. I couldn't quit drinking. But I went in the house, and I knew that I could not quit drinking. I had tried really hard not to drink for years before that night. I mean, every day with me, it was trying not to take a drink that day, and then having just that one drink. Just that one, I convinced myself, and of course it was never that one drink, and then I would drink all day long. But I went in the house and I knew that I couldn't quit drinking. So I picked up the telephone and I called my husband's brother, who was a Catholic priest, and I called him because I thought that he could pray for me. And I knew nothing about this program, or nothing about alcoholism being a disease. I didn't know what I had. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I kind of visioned myself, if anybody ever knew what I was doing, I thought they would lock me up in the basement of a mental hospital and leave me there for the rest of my life. And so I called this priest just thinking he could pray for me, and he had been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous so he could see what it was like. And he told me to go. He lived on the East Coast, and I was in California. And so I went upstairs and I got I was mostly wearing cut-off Levi's and white t-shirts at this time, and I was very heavy, and my hair was orange, and it was crackly because I dyed it every other day. I would just, out of boredom of being locked in my house with my kids, I would dye my hair and rearrange furniture. And I mean, like, I would make the bedroom the den and things like that, like major rearranging, you know. I couldn't go out anymore. I couldn't go out because I drank in the morning. As soon as my husband left to go to work, I drank, and people had smelled it on me and made remarks. And so by this time, I was staying in my house. And but I went upstairs that night, and I picked out this outfit to wear, which was an orange polyester pantsuit. And I thought that I looked really nice, and my hair was orange, and my face was orange, too. And I think even if I hadn't thrown up at the meeting, they would have known I was a newcomer, just by the way I looked. But So we started off to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I guess my husband called somebody and found out where it was, and we got there. And they weren't there. They had moved somewhere else. This caretaker told us they were somewhere else, and we went to this other place, and they had moved, and it was like, I thought, you know, they know I'm coming, and so they're moving. And I never thought people wanted me around them. And so we finally found it, the third place we were directed to go, and we arrived about 25 after 9, and the meeting was over about 9:30, and we went in and sat down, and there were about 25 people in that room, and there was a speaker, and he finished talking, and the meeting was over, and that's when all 25 people came surrounding me, and they had cake and coffee and literature and phone numbers, and I had no idea what was going on, but I found out later they had not had a newcomer out there in a long time, and they all wanted to get in on this newcomer, you know. And when I started throwing up on the floor, I ran outside to the parking lot because I had been drinking all day, but I wasn't so drunk that I didn't know what was going on, and I was embarrassed, and I ran outside. And they all came outside, and they formed a circle. They were like, they were holding hands, you know, and looking up at the stars, really. And this man said, you know, we alcoholics are so lucky, we're chosen by God. And I don't think that I really quite believed it that night, you know. I had been in a lot of pain, you know, and I had no idea what was going to happen to me. When we were driving to find the meeting for the third place, you know, I was trying to jump out of the car by that time because I'd started to think about this, what was happening. And I said to my husband, what are these people going to do? Chain me up. I cannot quit drinking. And, but, you know, these ladies talked to me that night. They wanted me to stay there with them, and I wouldn't because I was afraid. And I was holding on to my husband's pant leg like I was a little two-year-old kid, and I would not stay there. They scared me, and I didn't know what they were going to do to me. And the next day, they showed up at my house, and I was just sitting on my couch staring at the walls, and they showed up, these two older women. I was in my 20s then, and they were in their 50s, and they brought this other lady with them who was in her 30s because they thought they would scare me away. They thought they were too old. And she was in between slips, I found out later. They got this lady on a good day, and and they brought her along. And all they did that day was sit there, and they read to me a little bit out of the book As Bill Sees It, and they read to me out of the 24-hour book, and they shared their experience, strength, and hope with me. And it really was almost like an instantaneous thing. I had this feeling that everything was going to be all right. And they met me for a meeting that night. They took me to another meeting, and this lady got up. And this lady was the main speaker, and I could not believe the things that she was saying at the podium in front of these people. I could not believe these secrets that she was divulging and the way she was talking about herself. And I had a lot of secrets and a lot of things that I was ashamed of. And I never thought I would tell anybody some of these things, but in time, you know, I've heard it all in, you know, all my secrets expressed at podiums and at a lot of the meetings that I've gone to. But I remember that night when at that meeting, when they asked for newcomers to raise their hand, and I put my hand up and I put my head down, and I was so ashamed of myself, and it was hard for me to realize that everybody in that room had come there for the same reason, and they were all alcoholics. And that was the beginning. And then they did not have very many meetings out there, and the next meeting I attended was on a Friday. That was the very next meeting they had. It was a woman's meeting, and they went around the room and read from As Bill Sees It. And I would just, each lady took a turn reading, and they counted, you know, which page they were going to read, and I wouldn't pay any attention, which I had done all my life. I was very self-obsessed. I never heard anything else that was going on. I was thinking about me. And I would count the ladies, and I would count the pages, and figure out which page I would have to read when it was my turn, and I would practice it in my mind so I wouldn't say anything wrong because I didn't want them to think that I was stupid, and I'd practice what I was going to say. And you know, that was my beginning into Alcoholics Anonymous. I happen to come from a family of alcoholics. I have five brothers who are all sober today, who are all alcoholics. My father died of alcoholism when I was here sober about 6 months. And I have a sister who has all the living problems that I do, and she calls me all the time with her problems, and I try to give her help, and it doesn't work because she doesn't really have to take these actions. And I finally told her I had a solution to her life, and I could make her very happy, and that was, I said, go out and get drunk and take drugs and get in trouble, and then come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything would be okay. And, you know, that's joking. I say that to her, but, you know, looking back on that night I was going, I was thinking of my family that night, and my brothers had all been in a lot of trouble, and I was saying that night, why me? I was saying, why me? Why do I have to go do this? Why do I have to quit drinking? And it turned, that feeling turned around in a very short time, and I felt like, why me? Why was I the lucky one to be chosen? You know, I believe that my disease of alcoholism is a gift, and that's just my personal belief, and I just base that on the kind of life that I live today, and the rewards that I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous through other people, working with other people and sharing with other people and seeing miracles happen. I believe that this is a gift, and I'm glad that I'm an alcoholic. But my mother is a professional martyr, because every alcoholic family needs a martyr. And after my father died of alcholism, she complained to him and screamed at him all the time about his drinking. And the first man she dated after my father died was this a slipper that I had met in Alcoholics Anonymous. The worst slipper I'd ever met. He was always burning down his trailer and getting run over by cars. And my mom meets this man just out in the regular world. She meets this man, you know. And so she tried to take care of him for a while. He finally got sober and stayed sober, so she gave him up. And she's married to a man today who doesn't work, so she's still a happy woman, and she still has things to complain about, so that's fine. I directed her to Al-Anon once, and she found out that you work on yourself there, and that didn't interest her. So anyway, she's happy. But I was when I was a teenager, I was a real wild teenager and all that stuff. You know, first of all, I don't have time. And there's a couple of things, you know, what I have found since I've been sober, and that is that we all share the same feelings inside, and it does not make any difference what we did to get here. It makes no difference at all. Every action that we took is, usually stems from our insecurities and our fears, and we just show these in different ways. And one thing that I always like to mention is, by the way, everything that I've learned, I only learned in my sobriety. I knew nothing when I got here, absolutely nothing. I was just like this helpless little, like a retarded, you know, just a doormat, and I just did whatever anybody wanted me to do, and it was very important to me that everybody in the world like me. Now, that's one of the things, I didn't know that before I got here. I had no idea what was going on. But when I was 15 years old, I got pregnant, and it's funny because I didn't have a boyfriend, and I'd never been on a date in my whole life, you know. But, and I was going to Catholic school, too, and they didn't have maternity uniforms in my school, so. But you know, this man that I knew, that he was a lot older than I was, and he used to dare me. I used to keep this horse at a stable, and this man was a stable hand at this place, but he used to dare me to sneak out of my house in the middle of the night. And I had to do anything that anybody dared me to do at that time in my life, and even, you know, into my sobriety. And I just had to. And so I would climb out of my window in the middle of the night and go up and say, ha ha, I did it, here I am. And and I got pregnant. And, and you know, I found, my parents made up this big story that I'd gone to visit relatives, you know, because they didn't want anybody to know. And I was living with a family and taking care of their kids and cleaning their house. And I would write letters, and my parents would send them to somebody in Pennsylvania, and they'd send them back to my friends so they'd have the right postmark. And I was just calling my friends on the phone anyway and telling them how big I was getting. And, I found out a while after that my two older brothers found this guy and they ambushed him and they broke his jaw. And, you know, I felt so bad. I felt like it was all my fault. I felt really bad for that man that they did that to him, you know. And, you know, obviously I had no self-worth, and it didn't come popping into my life just because I quit drinking either. And it's taken, you know, it's a process with me. It's this whole thing is a process, and I just believe everything that I go through now. I mean, I've come to believe in God's will, and I believe that everything that I go through and that happens is meant to be, and I accept it. And if it's a seemingly bad thing, I try to learn something from it, because that seems to be the only way that I can learn. You can't tell me not to do something. You know, we're all like that. I have to go do it, and I have to prove that, you know, I always think it's going to be different, but I don't drink, and I have had the support. You know, I was in this group for 15 years, and I just had this incredible support system here, and these lifelong friendships that I have now that mean so much to me. But I also, when I was a teenager, I went to work in a dental office after I graduated. I went back and graduated from high school, and in that dental office, you know, I would go into work an hour early every day. I never took a lunch hour, and I would stay 2 hours after work, and I'd go in on the weekends and shampoo the carpets, and nobody asked me to do that. I thought I had to do that. I thought I would get fired if I didn't do that, because I just felt so inadequate. But then when I got sober, I also realized that I was taking his money, so I must have felt guilty, and I learned that's called embezzling. The way I did it, that's what it's called. But see, then I thought, well, I should have all this money because I'm coming in doing all this extra work. So, I don't know. But I, when I worked in that office, I took pills all day long, and I didn't know why I took them. I always preferred alcohol. But when you're standing over people all day long sucking the water out of their mouths, you know, you don't want to smell. So I took pills. And then I got married, you know, because I was told that I would grow up and get married and have children. And that's where I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was younger, I ran around with people who drank a lot, and so I didn't have to notice my own drinking so much. When I got married and we had twins, I had to stay inside the house, and that's when it got really bad for me because... you know, it was like noontime. I would say I can drink. It's lunchtime. The men are drinking. They're all out working. It's their lunch hour. I can drink. This is my job. And then it would be 11 o'clock. I would give myself permission to have a drink because I got up at 5. I'm having an early lunch. And but then, you know, somewhere along the way, I discovered that taking a drink cured a hangover. And I had lots of hangovers. I always got sick, and I always threw up, and I broke blood vessels in my eyes, and I looked ugly. And I went out to the store, and I stole things, and I didn't take very good care of my kids. I locked the twins in the bedroom one time. I put a lock on the outside of their bedroom door because I couldn't deal with them because I was depressed all the time. I was very sad about the way my life was going. I thought that this is just the way I'm going to be the rest of my life. The world is passing me by. Nobody understands me. And I couldn't deal with them, and I locked their bedroom door, and we had a mountain behind our house, and I just sat up on the mountain and sat up there and cried and drank my wine. By that time, I was tired of spending so much money on stuff that I just threw up anyway. And so I drank a lot of wine. And sometimes my husband would try to catch me and come home at lunchtime. And I was drinking before lunchtime now. So I would wax the floor and I would put his lunch up on the counter. In case he came home, there it was. And I was drinking and I was in the corner and the floor was all wet and he couldn't walk on it. So he couldn't smell my breath. And I was living in this beautiful house out in Thousand Oaks, and there were a lot of nice people that lived on that street, and I felt very ashamed, you know. I would always be looking out my window at these ladies, and I would always be making fun of them in their dresses and their makeup and their earrings and thinking, who do they think they are out there? Why do they need to wear a dress? They're just cleaning their house. And this one lady was very nosy, and I didn't like her, and she gossiped all the time, and so she'd always be standing out in the street, so I would stand in my living room and I'd dial her phone number, and she was really top heavy too. And so I would watch her go plopping across the street, and just when she would get to her front door, I'd hang up, you know. And then she would come back outside, and then I would do it like 3 times, and she did it every time. And I'm just in my house drinking, you know, and like, and you know, I think at the time I thought these things were fun. I was very bored, you know, and then I would feel ashamed of doing these things. This same lady had this new patio put in, and she told everybody how much it cost. So one day when I saw her go away, I went sneaking through the backyards, and I took some eggs with me, and I threw them all over her patio. And, you know, I guess it's okay if you're a teenager. They do those kind of things. But I'm like the mother of these 3 kids, and I live in this nice house. And then if she'd ever catch me outside, she would tell me what these people behind her did. These horrible teenagers behind her threw eggs on her patio. And I would say, that's terrible. And, you know, and, well, just a lot of things happened. I was supposed to go to business parties with my husband. I would be drinking all day. When he'd go to get the babysitter, I'd have a few more and a few more and a few more because I did not fit in with those people. I never felt like a big lady. I didn't wear earrings and makeup, and I didn't get dressed up that often, and I had to go to these things sometimes, and I hated them because I did not know how to talk to those people. And every time they'd give me one drink, and I would have my head in the potatoes or something, you know, and one night I pushed all the men in the swimming pool, and it wasn't a swimming party, and they had suits on, and then they got tired of it, and they pushed me in the pool, and the ladies all took me in the bathroom to help me get undressed, and I wasn't into buying underwear because I didn't have time to do those things, and they weren't important to me, and I had this old bra on that was about 10 years old, and it was tied together with brown shoelaces, and that was very embarrassing. You know, the next day when I would wake up and I would think about these things, then I would call the people and ask them if I left my purse at their house. And my purse was with me, but I just had to feel them out, you know. This kind of thing just, you know, was just went on and on and on. And the kids, you know, that time I locked them in the bedroom, I came back in the house, and one of them had climbed up the front of a dresser and cut his head open, and there was blood all over the bedroom. And another time, I just left them in the backyard, and one of them drank charcoal lighter, and that's very dangerous. And if I ever let them go out, they'd get on their big wheel and take off, and I couldn't find them. And I was drinking, and people would smell my breath, and it was just too much for me. And you know, and just these kinds of things went on and on and on, and until that day, you know, it was not any really big thing. I'd had this affair with this old boyfriend, and I lied about that, and it was just a combination of everything. Every day I tried not to drink, as long as I can gauge it by the age of the twins, who were 3 years old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did that thing of that I'm not going to have a drink today, I'm not going to have a drink, and then, well, I'll have just one. And then it was just all day long. And I hated myself. I look in the mirror to try to get ready to go somewhere, and one time I just turned around and put my fist through the bathroom wall. I just hated myself, and I just had no idea what, you know, I just thought this is the way it's going to be for the rest of my life. And so that day that when my husband you know, confronted me, you know, I did call this old boyfriend, and I wanted him to come pick me up. My first thought was that I would run away from my family, and I felt sorry for my kids, and I felt sorry for my husband. And then my husband came in the room and said, I don't care where you go, but you can't run away from it. And it must have been my time to come here. And And so I went to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and as I said before, it was like instant relief. And those ladies took me to the meeting that Monday night then, and they talked to me on the way home, and I remember a couple days after that I was sitting in my living room thinking, you know, it's been 3 days and I haven't had anything to drink and I haven't had to fight it at all, and this is just amazing. And I did not, all these women gave me their phone number, and I really wanted to call them up. And I didn't get a sponsor right away because I would sit by my telephone with these phone numbers thinking about what this lady looked like and wishing I could call her up. And then I thought that she would not know who I was, and I would have to describe myself, and I would have to say fat, ugly, and orange, because I could never say anything, I could not say anything nice about myself. And then I thought this lady would remember who I was, and inside she would go, oh no, it's her. And so I would just sit there and think this, and then I would just put the number down and I couldn't call. And I loved going to meetings. I really loved Alcoholics Anonymous. And but I continued to be a doormat. This lady out there asked if I could watch her daughter for the evening, and she came back 3 days later and picked her up. And I said, you know, like, that's no problem. You can leave her anytime. I hated this lady for doing it, you know, like, leave her till she's 18 if you want. It's no problem. And, you know, when I was younger, when I was a teenager, I remember walking down the street with a can opener in my hand and scratching paint off of people's cars. I didn't even know whose cars they were, but that's how I got back at you, for making me do things that I did not want to do. I didn't know I had any control over this at all, you know, and it was, I was into my sobriety, you know, quite a while before I learned that I had some control over these things. And when even today I get caught up in this of doing things that I don't want to do, and not in an AA request necessarily, and when I really think about it and I think, what is my problem here, I'm afraid that person won't like me. But, you know, somewhere along the line it changed with me, and I realized that I live with myself and they don't live with me, and I'm more willing to risk that maybe somebody doesn't like me now, and because I care much more about myself than when I got here. And so after 4 months, I took some tranquilizers one day out of my mother's house. You know, I went to meetings a lot, and I loved the meetings, but I didn't share with anybody. And I thought I needed to take these pills, and I thought, well, they've just made that part up in Alcoholics Anonymous. It just talks about drinking, and I'll take these pills. And then a couple days later, I happened to have a quart of wine in my refrigerator, because I used to cook with wine, and I would use like a teaspoon of this wine, and I'd have a quart in there, and I had it in there. And I, you know, said, well, I, my husband was late coming home and with the car, and I needed to go to a meeting, and I thought, he can't treat an alcoholic like this, because we might get drunk. And I went in and I got drunk, you know, I went up to the meeting, and I sat outside and watched all, you know, and I wanted to be in there. That was the silly part of this whole thing. I thought drinking would relieve some pressure. I had let some pressure build up. I didn't know what to talk to a sponsor about. I had no idea about all that. I've since learned that I need to talk to a sponsor about those seemingly small things that build up and you know, just grow into very large things. I've been able to handle large things in my sobriety, the death of my father, and one of my sons went to jail a few times, and I didn't like that, but I said the Serenity Prayer, and I was able to deal with it. But when my feelings are at stake, and I've been rejected, and I've been a doormat, and I've, you know, let people walk all over me, these things really can get to me. And I was sitting outside that meeting, and then I bought a half gallon of wine before I went up there. And then I was just driving around and thinking, you know, when I came here 4 months prior to that, I thought I was a very bad person, and I had done some very bad things in my life. And then when I came here and hearing people talk for 4 months, I realized I'm nothing. See, again, I'm nothing. They have these really wild stories, and I'm nothing. So I'll just, at least I could probably go to jail. So I drank this half gallon of Spinata on the Ventura Freeway, and then I threw the bottle out the window of the car and thought, I'll go to jail. And no, nobody saw me do that, and nobody cared, and I just kept driving, Then I went home and I woke up stuck to my blue shag den carpeting in my throw up one more time. And my husband had been to Al-Anon a couple times and he just was sitting there watching me. And the next day, you know, I got up and I was very scared and I had come over here. I had met some people in Thousand Oaks who brought me over here. They brought me to the yard one day and I used to come to the yard and bring my kids. My youngest son was a year old and I'd bring playpens and these kids, and I think it was, you know, in those days, kids got banned from the yard one time, and I think that's because of my kids, actually. But, you know, these people I met in Thousand Oaks, though, brought me over to this group, and I really loved it. And I met a lady in this group then who came up to me, and she said, "Let me be your interim sponsor." And I was so grateful to that lady for doing that, because I still couldn't go up to anybody and ask them. And I was so grateful to her. And, you know, she stayed sober a long time, and she died of another disease. And she stayed sober because she worked with newcomers. And I think that's what I was taught to do right from the beginning. And I would be pushed across the room to work with a newcomer, you know, whether I wanted to or not. As I said before, self-worth didn't pop into my life just because I didn't drink. And I still felt ugly and not like a female, and there would be a pretty woman that would come in, and I thought, she doesn't want to hear what I have to say. And I didn't like the way I felt sober. I didn't know how much I had relied on alcohol and how much alcohol had done for me all my life. I had no idea, and I didn't really like the feeling that I had sober. And I used to get depressed, and I used to sit in my closet all day long sometimes, and one time I bought a bottle. You know, I thought that I would never do that again, but I had this incredible pain, and I didn't know of any other way to get rid of it. I had never felt things like that in my life, but I didn't have to drink it, and what I did was go up to the regular meeting that I attended, one of the meetings. It was a Thursday night, and I found a lady from this group who was just walking in the door. You know, I knew she would be there, and I had heard her share from the podium, and I knew, I wasn't sure, but I thought she might understand. I still had this feeling like, my pain is different from your pain. It's more intense, and it's worse, and you don't understand. But I talked to this lady, and she did understand. And that's always been the way. I have learned so many things, you know, in growing up in my sobriety, and there has always been somebody there for me. I got divorced after about 3 years of being sober. I got divorced the first time. And I thought that I had no training to do anything. I had been a dental assistant, and that's all I could do. And I had to go out and get a job, and I had to get an apartment. And I thought I could do all these things until the day that I had to do them. I would call up, I'm 3 years sober, and people would say, "What salary do you expect?" And I'd say, "Whatever you want to pay me is okay." And I had my friends all gathered around me. They just walked me through that whole thing. And I was going out on these job interviews, and Susie was in the car with me one time, and I was going to drop her off, and I started crying. And I was afraid to go on this job interview. And she sat in the car out in front while I was in on this job interview, and for some reason they asked me to type, and I don't know how to type. And I couldn't even turn on the typewriter. But I was trying to learn, and, you know, rather than run out, I had to go into the other room, and I said, "Excuse me, could you tell me how to turn on the typewriter?" And, you know, and we laugh about these things today, and they weren't that much fun in those days, going through these things. And I took good care of my kids. In the beginning it was real difficult trying to raise these three little boys and go to meetings and do my AA things and work full time and get babysitters, and financially it wasn't very good. And sometimes I think if I don't tell you I quit drinking, you wouldn't know, because I've done everything in my sobriety that I did drinking, and I don't recommend it. I'm just telling you that's what I did, but I never had to drink over it, and there was always somebody that I could go to and talk about these things. And I started borrowing money from the dental office where I worked, and it got to be quite a large sum of money, and he caught me. And I picked up the phone and I called my sponsor and I said, I'm in trouble. And people stayed with me that night. And they said, you just go in tomorrow and you say you're sorry. And that's it. Don't make up excuses and all that. And I did that. And I didn't even get fired from that job. And when I was 12 years sober, I had remarried again. And I, you know what, I short-circuited is what I did. And I had been in this group all this time and I just took off one day. I just took off, and I think it's nice to have a nervous breakdown in Hawaii if you're going to have one. That's a good place to go. And that's where I went. And, you know, I like to mention this because, well, first of all, I got off the plane, and I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. There were about 15 people in this little town that I went to. Half of them were smoking marijuana, and I decided to define sobriety for them. And they didn't like it, and they were fighting with me, arguing and everything. And then I wrote a letter to New York, and I reported them, and I took care of everything. But you know, when I came back from that, I was 12 years sober. And I came back, and I felt like, you know, I would sit in these meetings, the meetings I had been in my whole sobriety, and I'd look around at all my friends who were sober the same length of time, and they all seemed to be, their marriages were good and their jobs were good. And I thought, you know, I just keep screwing up. I screwed up again. Am I ever going to stop doing this? And I would sit in the back of the meeting, you know, with my arms folded, and I would be feeling bad. But the thing is, I was in the meeting. I was in the meeting thinking that, and I finally realized I just have to go back to the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't matter that I was 12 years sober and I had done this and that. You know, it didn't make any difference, and I went back to the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous. And things turned around, you know. It didn't take long, and things turned around. And, you know, I love working with people. I love working with newcomers. I have women that I sponsor, and I really love them a lot. And they mean a lot to me in my life. And I think working with people is the most important thing that I can do for my sobriety. And I also love the Pacific Group very much. And Clancy's been my sponsor for a long time, and he's been very good to me. And I have really grown up here. So I hope those of you that are new stick around, and those of you that don't feel so good tonight, please come back again. Thank you.